This show is a member of Goblin, the gaming broadcast network, gbncom.com.
This is Luke Johnson, the hyper writer who's worked with Wizards of the Coast, White Wolf, Goodman Games, and you're listening to The Tome! Woo!
Welcome to The Tome, episode 40. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interviews podcast, and I am your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, we will be going over the hill with 4th edition rules. Welcome again to episode 40 of The Tome, 4th edition rules. Hey, look at that. The Tome's 40. We're over the hill. We're on our way down. We're on the second half of our life. Oh, does that mean I'm going to die soon? I hope not. The show's going strong and going on long. No big news this time around because I'm recording this about 30 seconds after I recorded the last episode. So let's just jump right into some 4th edition discussions between myself and Chris Engler about some of the rules of 4th edition. Please remember that information is from official sources only and was current at the time of recording. And this is the last part of our conversation about 4th edition. We got through half of my notes, and so we're going to get together some other time and record some more chit-chat. If you have any feedback about whether or not you like the format of having Chris on the show, he and I have chit-chatted about maybe having him around a little bit more often. Let me know if you want him around and or anybody else, or if you want me to try to get together with some of the other reporters for the show or any other people that have done sections for the show. Let me know and I'll try to get them on, and we can do chats like this more often as, of course, schedules allow. But in any case, here we go. 4th edition rules. Let's talk a little bit now about some of the rules changes. We have a section just about rules, and the first thing we have on here is some of the things that are not changing. Critical hits are still in, armor class is still in, flanking, standard actions, free actions, move actions, all of those things are still there as we know them from 3rd edition. So this might be the area where we say, okay, some of the basics of the game are the same.
Right.
Although it does seem that the way some of those things work specifically might be changing, in as much as some of the play tests, for example, show that some creatures seem to get more than one standard action at a time.
Yeah, I didn't quite get that. I mean, then,
well, for example, in a play test, they might have talked about how the dragon is clawing at somebody and casting a spell at the same time, which normally in 3rd edition would be impossible because attacking is a standard action, casting a spell is a standard action. You can't do two of those. But it seems that now there are some abilities that will allow some creatures to do that.
Yeah, I just find that, there would be different ways to, I'm not a game designer, but it seems to me there would be different things to skin that cat, different ways to skin that cat that would accomplish the same thing. Because, I mean, when you've got, one of the things that a rule is supposed to do is to provide, black and white clarity. And, to have a rule like, you can perform one standard action and one move action in a round. If you've got too many exceptions to that, I mean, the impact of saying something is a standard action sort of diminishes, you know what I mean?
Right. Well, and it's sort of ironic that you bring that up, because it's sort of going the opposite direction from what they've talked about for, attacks of opportunity. Now, they've taken attacks of opportunity and said, oh, well, yeah, if you do this, then you take an attack of opportunity. Accept this, accept this, accept this, accept this. That's the way 3rd edition works. And they've said, well, for 4th edition, attacks of opportunity are going to be much more clear. You're either going to get it or you're not, and there's not going to be all the exceptions to have to worry about. And so
I thought that
should be more clear, but then again, maybe they're going to muddy the waters with standard actions.
Yeah, because I mean, I remember first reading through third edition, you know, the idea of attacks of opportunity. I thought that was, you know, a good thing to do. But I mean, when I think of the number of times that I've actually had to resolve an attack of opportunity, I mean, it's negligible because there's so many ways to get out of them.
Oh, and see, I find, especially in my most recent campaign, I'm dealing with attacks of opportunity all the time.
Huh, interesting.
But I think it comes down to the kinds of characters that are in the game, because the guy who's taking a lot of attacks of opportunity is a guy who's he's using a spike chain, first of all, so he gets 10 feet of reach. Plus, he also it gets enlarged a lot, so then he suddenly has 20 feet of reach, and anybody who's moving within 20 feet of him risks the attack of opportunity.
Right.
So,
but he's built a character that's, you know,
taking advantage of that.
His thing is that, you know, he wants to be able to provoke attacks of opportunity,
right,
from his opponents. So, that's, I mean, that's
exactly right.
Yeah.
Whereas, on the other hand, I don't see, you know, if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't see a lot of attacks of opportunity happening, because, like you said, there's a lot of ways out of it. But that's also changing the strategy of the game. I mean, the way people move on the board or on the battle map is different, and the kinds of attacks they take are different because they're avoiding the attacks of opportunity. And so it does impact the game in that way.
I kind of feel the same way about firing into melee. Like, you know, every character that I've ever come across in the games that I'm running. I mean, it's funny, in the One Iron Kingdoms game that I'm running right now, I mean, we've got, you know, three characters, none of whom are a fighting class, and they all have precise shot.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the players knew enough about the rules to think, okay, well, I want to be able to be effective in melee. So, you know, they take a ranged weapon because they're not a hand-to-hand combat specialist, and they take precise shot. And I mean, the rules are there for them to use, and, you know, they I don't criticize them for using them, but it's so funny to me that something is, you know, as basic as saying, okay, shooting into melee should be dangerous for your allies, you know, with the selection of 1 feat at first level is completely co-opted.
Sure.
And I worry about the same thing for things like, you know, standard actions or attacks of opportunity. They're supposed to have, you know, very well laid out consequences. But, you know, the published rules to get around them are, you know, too many, in my opinion.
Sure. Well, yeah. And on the other hand, I don't always, you know, I want those options to be there. And I guess it's just sort of that issue of, if something seems too awesome, everybody ends up taking it. So sort of like when we were talking about multi-classing.
For sure.
One of the other things that I'm really intrigued by is the hit point system. And that there'll still be a hit point system, but it's not going to be the old D20 for barbarians, D6 for rogues, you know, D4 for sorcerers, that kind of stuff. The idea that they're saying is they want to make it easier for first-level characters to survive. They don't get into one fight, one bad swing, and suddenly they're dead.
And I guess that makes sense because, I mean, the combat system in D&D compared to other games, I mean, it's not supposed to be... I mean, D&D is a game about going out and getting into fights. You
right.
know, it's not like, you know, Call of Cthulhu, where you're supposed to do everything you can to not get in a fight because your adversaries are so formidable that if you do, you're guaranteed to die.
Sure.
So, you know, I think that's a good idea given the feel that D&D wants to have.
Yeah, I think it is too. I'm just curious how they're going to pull it off. Because, I mean, again, looking at identity, the idea of rolling a die at every level to gain hit points seems to be a part of what D&D is.
You ever play Hackmaster?
I have not.
Because Hackmaster is actually, it's a Wizards licensed product, believe it or not, that Kenzer and Company makes. They got the rights from Wizards to publish the first edition D&D rules, and it's self-parody, but it is an entirely playable system. And, you know, it's the whole point of Hackmaster. I mean, just you can guess from the name is, you know, it's hack first, ask questions later.
Right.
And, you know, they give characters at first level, like all the hit die types and everything are, you know, as they were in first edition, you know, magic users had D4, you know, fighters have D10, but every class starts with 20 plus the number of hit dice, like, you know, 20 plus the first level hit dice.
Sure.
Well, so maybe they're doing something like that.
So I wonder, yeah, I wonder if they're not just starting people with a bonus to hit points at first level, and then they just gain as they go on. I could even see making, you know, your first level hit points being your hit die plus your con.
Yeah, that'd be a good way to do it.
I think that might be, yeah. Because, I mean, even then, your wizard's likely to have, you know, 12 or 14 hit points, which is a lot better than 3.
For sure. But what's going to make that interesting is, you know, for that to mean something to me, that means that they aren't doing it for all the typical monsters that you'd encounter at first level. Because,
right.
I mean, okay, if you're going to give a kicker to all your first level characters and give them all to the goblin, I mean, essentially all you've done is made combat longer.
Sure. Because now everybody has more hit points.
Yeah. So that's a big shift, because that's all of a sudden, you know, that's really making the, you know, the goblins and kobolds and all those other things that you're accustomed to encountering at first level. I mean, those are truly fodder then at that point.
Yeah. Of course, and we'll talk about this as we talk about monsters, which is our next section. The way they're approaching monster design is very different. And so that might answer some of that, because they're no longer necessarily being real strict with this monster has to follow the same rules as a character who's being designed. And that it can be them saying, well, kobolds are supposed to die easily and attack in massive swarms, so let's design a monster with low hit points that attacks in massive swarms, and it doesn't have to follow the rules that the PCs follow. So that shift might sort of explain how that's all going to fit in.
Yeah, it could be.
They're still using the one-inch square as a standard for an assumption, I guess, for combat. There was some talk that maybe they'd go to the hex maps, because some players like those a lot more.
Oh, really?
Right. Well, a lot of people, I think, don't like having to deal with the diagonals on a square map. And if you have a hex map, you don't have to do that. But they've decided to stick with the one-inch square.
Well, I mean, you can't really think of, you know, unless you want to really turn it into a miniatures game where you're busting out the tape measure. I mean, you have to accept some level of abstraction. I mean, it's, you know, kind of like the whole, okay, if I move, you know, 4 feet and 11 inches away from my opponent, I'm still engaged with them. But if I move 5 feet away, I'm not. I mean, you know,
right.
You can split hairs that finely as well. So I don't have a big problem with that. I mean, yes, you know, moving diagonally, you are moving further given your movement rate, you know, when you're translating it literally. But I mean, again, it's all about resolving things quickly.
Yeah. And we've already talked about the changes in saving throws, but one of the connections to that is that there's no longer going to be a touch AC anymore.
Yeah, I was surprised to see that.
Instead, they're going to have to hit your reflex save, which sort of makes sense, right? Because the whole idea of touch AC is that it's all a, can you hit the person and they're just sort of dodging with their own natural finesse. And reflex save is going to end up representing the exact same sort of idea, because it's just going to be that target number to hit to hit that person despite their natural finesse.
But the touch AC took into account the fact that you only got a dex bonus up to a certain point depending on the kind of armor you wore, so I hope they keep that in.
I would imagine if they did keep that in, what they would do is they would have certain penalties to your reflex bonus for wearing certain armor.
Which makes a lot of sense, actually.
Because that's now that we talk about it, that's something that doesn't really make sense in third edition. That your armor can penalize your dex bonus, but you, for the most part, you're still getting your reflex is largely unaffected. I mean, I suppose if your dex bonus is lower, then your reflex modifier is a little bit lower too, but I know whenever I build a PC, I always build it so that doesn't happen.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to have the effect it ought to if you're wearing like non-magical plate mail.
Right.
Like you're bad at, you know, dodging someone coming up and touching you, but you're just fine at, you know, cartwheeling out of the way of a fireball.
Sure. Yeah, see, I wonder I wonder if that's not the route they're going to take, is saying, okay, you can wear your full plate armor, but you're going to take a minus 10 to your reflex save or whatever it is.
Well, it's good because now they're using, you know, the same thing to do two different things.
Right. And I think that, yeah, I think that's going to, I mean, because a lot of people have complained with third edition that some of the number crunching just gets too complex. And I think touch AC is a big part of that. You know, what counts in that and what doesn't count in that. And I don't know where it is, or, oh no, I forgot this bonus and all that kind of stuff. And I think they're trying to make it a little bit more simpler. You've got your reflex save, you've got your AC. Those are two different things and they're not changing. They're the same.
I think a lot of that falls on the GM too, because I mean, if you've got, you know, there's more rules in the player's handbook and the Dungeon Master's Guide than any normal person can memorize. And
sure.
I think part of the hallmark of being a good GM is carrying yourself with enough authority at the table that if somebody makes a roll and they think for all the world that they've made it, you know, you have to be able to communicate in a way and say, no, that didn't make it, that they don't question it. Now, that's not to say that you should, you know, ignore the dice on the table. But I mean, if you're in a situation where the letter of the rules falls short of the spirit of the rules, you know, I think as a DM or a GM, you know, you're obligated for the sake of the story that you're trying to present, because that's your contribution to the game, is, you know, you're providing the story. I mean, if you're not providing something that, how can I say this, that, you know, makes it, that provides an experience that makes sense, you know, if you're just strictly looking up numbers on tables, I mean, the players don't really need you.
Right. No, I agree. There is definitely some responsibility on the DM to handle a lot of that stuff.
So all the DMs out there, you know, don't take crap from your players.
They're going to have more rules now dealing with terrain. They want to make the environment of an encounter as much a character as the actual characters, is the way they sort of talked about it. They want to have more interesting things going on with your environment.
Yeah, I was surprised to hear them say that, because I thought the rules as they exist for, you know, terrain and cover were pretty robust. So I'm interested to see what they have planned for that.
Well, and I wonder if it's not going to be more of getting bonuses for high ground and having more examples in the books of, you know, a section of weakened floor with, you know, so you, if you step on it, you fall here, or that kind of stuff. I sort of have seen, as I've looked at like pre-written adventures since third edition came out, I've seen terrain playing a bigger and bigger role in the adventures in the last several years. And so I just wonder if they're not saying, well, we're going to basically do what we've been doing lately, but we're going to do it in the Dungeon Master Guide. You know, we're going to do it from the beginning and give you all this information about terrain.
Yeah, I just would, you know, be concerned that, you know, it turns into too much of a miniatures game.
You know, well, and my concern as a DM is that a lot of times I ignore a lot of the terrain anyway. I mean, if it's not dynamic and really interesting, it's usually just a headache and a pain, you know. I've been playing through the Cormyr adventure, and there's certain spots where it's like, oh yeah, all of these squares over here and all those over there, they're covered in this debris and it has this effect and it has this modifier and it has that. And it's like, you know what? I don't even want to draw all the little squares with all the debris and that kind of stuff. I want to describe it, but I don't want to have to deal with all the little modifiers and all the tweaks. And every time you go into the square, this crazy thing happens. And it's like, that's just more work than necessary. So there's some areas where terrain becomes more of a headache than I think it's worth.
Well, it has to be relevant too, right? I mean, you know, if you're in a movie and, you know, if you think of a movie and, you know, two guys are having a sword fight in the rain, you know, I mean, the terrain that they're walking on is going to be affected by that. And,
sure,
you know, should reflect the flavor of the fight. But, you know, if those same two guys are, you know, having a sword fight in the rain and then, you know, there happens to be, you know, a hedge nearby. I mean, who cares that there's a hedge, you know?
Right. Well, and even, you know, even if you're talking about the rain, I can totally see myself describing the rain and making it at least in description as a DM, making it a character in the story, but at the same time, I don't necessarily want to remember that they have a balance check that they have to make every round because of the slick surface or whatever. That doesn't necessarily add to the story, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it only really would if you had one guy in the fight that was typified as, you know, being either ultra dexterous or, you know, one guy that's, you know, maybe a little bit clumsy, where, okay, the fact that, you know, there is now a slippery surface now materially affects one of them. But if, you know, if they're on par in terms of their ability, I mean, you know, it cancels out.
One of the other things they're talking about is that, and I actually kind of like this idea, the idea that quests now have levels also. And so once you've completed a certain quest, then you earn experience points that's appropriate for whatever the difficulty of that quest was.
Now, I read that, and I didn't understand how that was different from the way it is now.
Well, the way they talk a lot about there being story bonuses or whatever in a game, but the whole idea now is that it's not just going out killing monsters and getting experience for that. There's other ways to get experience that involve completing a quest or completing a task or completing a mission. So you could go out and do something that never has anything to do with swinging a sword or defeating a trap or whatever, but you've successfully talked the Baron into not attacking his neighbor's village. Well, you've completed that quest. Here's your experience.
That's good. The one thing that I wonder with that is, you know, does D&D really have the mechanics to occupy a four-hour gaming session to do that? Like, if you think about, okay, you've got these guys, and they can either, you know, there's Village A and Village B, and Village B has been attacking Village A, and, you know, Village B's baddies are all in a keep. I mean, you can either go through enter in the front door of the keep and, you know, fight all the baddies, or you can enter into diplomatic relations with the head of the baddies. Well, D&D is well suited out for, you know, mapping out that castle, putting the monsters in rooms, equipping the monsters, or even if they're not even monsters, equipping the adversaries, and then, you know, going into direct confrontation with them. But when it comes to doing, you know, diplomacy, there's not a lot of mechanics around that. I mean, it's, you know, a diplomacy role. So I think that's, I like that they're saying that they're attaching experience points to, you know, non-combat encounters, but I haven't heard a lot of how they're going to let that take place on the game table in a way that, you know, occupies an evening in a way that's engaging for a table full of people.
Well, I think some of this goes back to, and it's, I don't think it's just a matter of giving experience for non-combat things. I think it's more than that. I think it's giving, it's doing what good DMs have been doing for years anyway, and making it part of the rules, which was sort of the mantra they gave for when they created third edition, is that we're going to take the things that people are doing anyway and make it part of the rules. And I think that's sort of what this is all about. You know, if as a DM, if my group of players have successfully completed a major story, then I want to reward them for that with some bonus experience points and do it appropriately for the way that they did it, you know? And I think that's more of where they're going with it, is that you'll get experience not just for killing monsters along the way, but when you get to the end of that big story arc, you've completed something, you've accomplished something, and your characters have probably learned something as part of that. And it's part of it's the combat that happened, and part of it's the non-combat that happened, but it's all rolled up together to say you've successfully finished this part of the story.
Yeah, I guess I just go back to, you know, when you read through the rules, like the actual rules information for Dungeons & Dragons, I mean, most of it is to do with encounters with monsters. And so, you know, if I'm somebody that's, you know, knows nothing about D&D or role-playing games, and I'm reading through the rules, I'm thinking, okay, this game, you know, is about encountering monsters and fighting them and overcoming them, you know, mainly through, you know, physical confrontation. So that's what I should be spending most of the time at the table doing, because, you know, I've heard different opinions and philosophical arguments on this. And, you know, one side of the board says, you know, well, you know, if the game's not doing for you what you need it to do, then, you know, just make up your own rules. And, you know, I guess I used to really think that, but then at this, you know, I've heard more of the counter side from various game designers saying, well, no, you know, if the game's not doing for you what you want to do in a game, then you're playing the wrong game. And I'm kind of moving more to that side of the spectrum. So, you know, if there's a, you know, if I'm playing a, you know, I know that if I'm playing a game where, you know, it's about, you know, a gaming session where, you know, we're going out as a party of stalwart adventurers to overcome an adversary in physical confrontations, then, you know, D&D is about the best game out there for that. And, you know, if they're going to start awarding experience points for things other than that, A, I'm really excited about that, because that's, at this, you know, again, you know, maybe I'm not the person to whom they're marketing, but, you know, at my point in life, that's what I want to do more of in a role-playing game. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'll be interested to see if they really have, if they're really committed to that and provide the mechanics to support it.
The impression I get from reading some of the playtest reports and that kind of stuff is that they definitely realize that the game has some flaws in social mechanics, and that it's something that they're going to or hoping to address with fourth edition. Now, specifically what they're thinking of doing, I don't have any information on that. And I think you're still going to see a D&D game that's focused primarily on physical confrontation, but I think you're going to see more of the non-confrontation mechanics available in this edition than in the previous one.
Yeah, and that's good. And like one thing that I've heard, you know, in response to that is I've heard people say, well, you know, you don't need rules for, you know, social interaction because you should just do it via role playing. And, you know, I disagree with that, because if you've got a player that, you know, and I'm talking about the player, not the character, the player, you know, isn't a person of many words, isn't a person that's used to speaking up and addressing people. I don't think it's fair to place the expectation on him in the context of a game that, you know, he has to succeed in a social interaction based on his own ability to role play that. And that's compounded by the fact that you'll have lots of times players will, you know, sacrifice on certain ability scores, depending on how you do character generation, but certain things like intelligence and charisma. Like, I mean, I can role play somebody that's dumber than me, but
right.
I can't role play somebody that's smarter than me.
Right.
And that's not because there's nobody smarter than me. That's just because I don't know what it's like to occupy the headspace of somebody that's smarter than me.
Mm-hmm.
And so there needs to be, if you're going to call it a game, you know, if you're not just doing, you know, improv theater in your basement, which is a great way to have fun if that's what you like. But, you know, if you're going to call it a game, there needs to be a way to, you know, by, you know, rolling dice, shuffling cards, you know, flipping coins, whatever, there needs to be a way to, you know, even though you may punch it up and, you know, maybe the DM will give you a bonus if you do a good job of, you know, playing in character. But, you know, there needs to be a mechanic within the context of a game that lets you do something like that you're not ordinarily able to do. And, you know, role-playing games in general have, you know, done a good job of, you know, coming up, you know, whether or not you want to say they're realistic or not, that's a whole other conversation. But
right.
If they've come up with lots of ways, let's say, to mimic, you know, physical confrontation and, you know, deal out the consequences of that. But they're only now starting to really delve into, you know, the finer point into the finer points into as much detail with different kinds of interaction.
Yeah, and I think what we've seen in a lot of ways with some of the indie games sort of becoming more and more popular these days, that there is a push towards story, and a push towards mechanics to deal with story and to deal with social mechanics and that kind of stuff. And I think this is just sort of their way of saying, look, we recognize that push and we're going to modify our game to accommodate that some people want to play that way. But I think at the same time, at its core, D&D is still going to be what it was in that it's a game primarily about physical conflict.
Agreed. And that's probably what it should stay as.
Right. Because it fills that niche very well, and it's been doing it for a long time.
Right.
One of the other things that we have here is that action points are now in. Action points are in. They are going to be for the player, for Player's Handbook, right up from the beginning. It's no longer something they're testing out for the Eberron setting, which is where action points first sort of made their appearance.
I'm a big fan of that.
I am, and I'm not. I like the idea of having the options to do cool things with action points, and it does make things, I guess, more cinematic. In that you can, every now and then, you can give it that extra boost to do something really neat. So that's really cool. On the other hand, on the issue of complexity, it is just one more thing to keep track of. And now I have, you know, 10 more options to keep in mind every time I'm doing something.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but you can use an action point. Can you use an action point to re-roll a result? Because I play several different games that have different variations on the action point theme. Because I like systems that enable you to do that, because there's nothing worse than, because the one thing that a lot of role playing games, including D&D, up till now haven't done is, you know, there's no mechanical difference between the roll you make to knock out the guard on your way into the castle than there is to deal the death blow to the dragon living in the deepest depths of the castle. And having something like action points, I think really, you know, I know some GMs are, you know, nervous or, you know, have trepidation about handing narrative control of their story to the player. But I mean, at the end of the day, you know, You want the players to succeed. I mean,
right?
Maybe they're affected in ways permanently. You know, maybe out of a group of eight at the end of the adventure, only, you know, two or three of them are left alive. But you know, you're telling a story. I mean, you're not, you know, it's not like the stereotypical, you know, Knights of the Dinner Table scenario where, you know, the DM is, you know, he only has fun when he defeats the players.
Right. Well, and in a world where you want, where you're talking about giving some narrative control to the players, action points is a very, very conservative way to do that. I mean, you're giving them some narrative control, but it's coming in the form of bonuses, which, I mean, considering other games that are talking about shared narrative between a DM and the players, giving bonuses for certain things is a pretty timid way of doing it.
Mm-hmm. I definitely think you can go too far in the other direction.
Sure.
But, you know, I like the fact that, you know, I mean, even though this may, but, you know, for people that have always played D&D, and, you know, there's lots of players of role-playing games where, you know, D&D, even to this day, when, you know, there's so many different options. I mean, there's a lot of people that, you know, all they play is D&D. So having something like this where, you know, as a player, you get the discretion as to when your character gets a bonus and when they don't. I mean, that's huge. That's a pretty big shift in thinking.
Yeah, but it is a lot of fun. I mean, I've played some games where after you know, using action points, where I've done some really fun things using those action points. You know, there was the demon that I just couldn't hurt with my monk, and so I chose to grapple the demon and roll off of the edge of a cliff with the demon in my arms, and then use an action point to grab onto the ledge at the last minute and watch the demon plummet to its death.
See, that's excellent.
Yeah, and that was brilliant. I mean, I loved it, and it gave me some narrative control, but it was in a very limited way. You know, it was, I got my bonus to grab onto the ledge, and that's basically where my action point came in. But it was a lot of fun.
And that's a great moment in a story. I mean, that's a way better story than you stood there round after round punching the demon until you knocked it out.
Right. Well, another change that we're seeing for the rules here is the perception is a new skill. That's as much information as we have. My assumption would be that perception is going to replace spot and listen and possibly search and roll them up into one skill.
Yeah, again, I think you're probably on the right track. Maybe just another time saver.
I think that's what it is. And
yeah.
On some hand, I think that makes sense in that it's simpler, I suppose. On the other hand, it also makes sense to do the other way. I mean, in a case of looking at things realistically, somebody might be good at noticing things visually, but not so good at hearing them. You know, I can see the reason that there would be a difference, but I can also see that for time saving, and I can also make logical sense of I'm the kind of person that just notices the little thing, whether it be listening to it or seeing it, I just notice the little thing. So it makes sense either way.
And there may be, you know, a feat that accentuates that. You know, I mean, and what you're doing is, I mean, the less lines you have on the character sheet to fill in, you know, probably the better in terms of decreasing complexity. But I mean, it's in a way it's also kind of a closed system. Like if you take away a level of complexity in one aspect of the game, it has to take up space somewhere. I guess just the, you know, from my perspective, the science is okay. Let's simplify the things that come up the most. And then, you know, okay, we'll still have lots of situational modifiers, but, you know, given the frequency that they come up, it's better to have them, you know, referenced somewhere on a table than occupying three different skill lines on a character sheet.
Right. Well, and our last little bit of news here on changes to some rules deals with some of the categories that they've come up with for levels. They've now said that levels 1 through 10, they're calling heroic. 11 through 20 is paragon, and 20 through 30 is your epic levels. And that different things happen to characters at those different levels. And this is their sort of way to try to break up the sweet spot that we talked about before. In saying that, well, you no longer have this odd little sweet spot floating around in the middle. Instead, you have really cool things to do 1 through 10, and then you have different really cool things to do 11 through 20, and other different really cool things to do from 20 to 30. And that ties into feats also, which are getting a bit of an overhaul, because there are certain feats that are available to you at a heroic level and certain feats that are available as a paragon and epic.
See, and I think this is, you know, as I read this, you know, the way I read between the lines is, you know, this is sort of doing what we were talking about earlier, is taking something that's, you know, definitive about Dungeons and Dragons, like levels, and melding them into the new way that people are thinking. Like most role-playing games that I see now, or at least those that I play, that have advancement, you know, there's still advancement, but, you know, there's the number of times you advance is, you know, a lot fewer. And, you know, here I'm seeing, okay, they've grouped everything into, you know, heroic, paragon, and epic, but they've left that, you know, that old comfortable notion of levels in there between 1 and 10.
Yeah.
And so, or 11 and 20 and 20 and 30. So that's sort of, you know, given my perspective, that looks to me like what they're doing. So, I mean, okay, there's really only, if I'm interpreting this right, there's really only three levels of character. That's not to say that everybody that's epic is the same, but in terms of how you're going to be grouping, and because, you know, they're grouping feats the same way, you know, in terms of the things you have access to, you know,
right.
It doesn't matter whether you're 11th level or 19th level. It's going to matter whether you're a paragon.
Well, and I think of it as, in a lot of ways, I think of it as the heroic level party is saving the city, the paragon level is saving the kingdom, and the epic level is saving the world.
Yeah. I think you're right.
And then the other thing they mentioned about feats is that the feats are no longer going, it seems like in some ways anyway, the feats are no longer going to be as big and as flashy as they were for third edition. They're saying now that all the cool things that you want to do are going to be based on your class. feats are going to be there to do sort of the fine tuning and to specialize your class to make it you more unique and more to whatever flavor you want to add to it. Feats are more of a flavor thing, I guess, than they are the big flashy cool things you can do.
Right. So, I mean, maybe we'll see things like, you know, power attack and cleave disappearing as feats.
And instead, there'll be an option that a fighter could take.
Yeah, or just even just a level-dependent benefit.
Yeah. Which, I guess, on some hand, I say, okay, that's fine. Not a big deal, because I'm still getting to do cool things. On the other hand, it also seems that it does limit a little bit of my customizability. I can no longer be the wizard with weapon focus. You know, that's something that the fighter gets, and I can't pick that up unless I pick up levels of fighter.
And I guess that comes down to, you know, personal taste. I mean, my own thing is, you know, I prefer to see character classes or class, that's a D&D word, but, you know, just characters in role-playing games. I prefer to see them a little more siloed, like, and that if you want to have, you know, if you want to be a mage that has weapon focus, I mean, I just personally feel that, you know, the sacrifice to be able to do that should be a lot more than currently exists in 3.5. Sure. So, I mean, that has to do with, you know, my age and, you know, what I was weaned on, which was AD&D first edition,
right.
Which, you know, there was, you know, you were a wizard or you were a fighter, and, you know, near the two met.
Well, and see, I was always the guy growing up in my youth, and so I can see where you're coming from, but I was always the guy that wanted to be the exception to the rule. So I like having the option to do that with third edition, and it seems that they're taking some of that option away now.
And there's just a natural kind of, you know, I guess ebb and flow as in terms of design. I mean, you're either gonna provide that flexibility to, you know, at the, you know, buffet of feats, and, you know, give them to practically everybody, and then the natural outcome of that is going to be, you know, probably convergence to people take, you know, a lot of people taking the same thing. I mean, you look on, you know, if you go to a convention and you tell, you know, 100 people to roll up a D&D character, and, you know, you isolate them, I bet you that, you know, the number of feats that they pick that are going to be in common, even if you tell, you know, this group of people make rogues, this group of people make fighter, this group of people make wizards, I bet you you're going to see a lot of commonality. You know, I don't think you're going to see a lot of people taking toughness.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, there's just going to be those feats that stand out that, you know, I mean, it is a game. I mean, why wouldn't you take the feat that gives you the greatest advantage?
Right.
So, I mean, I guess by limiting the options, making things only available to certain classes, you're sort of, how can I say this? Not pigeonholing people, but, you know, you're making what stands out about a certain class, you're making it stand out more, because it's like, okay, this guy just did a cleave. Okay, I know that he must be, you know, a warlord or a fighter of this level, if
right.
That's the way they're going.
Yeah. Well, I think that's where we're going to stop our little chit-chat for now. The listeners out there won't necessarily realize it, because I'll break this up into several different
sure.
episodes, but we've been talking for 2.5 hours now about this stuff. We still have monster news, D&D Insider, settings of different sorts to talk about, and then just my miscellaneous other category to
yeah.
chit-chat about someday. But I think this is where we're going to take a break, and maybe we'll get together then again in a month or so and slug through a little bit more of this. Well, okay, there's 4th edition rules. Now, another quick promo.
Listen to The Tome's new episode on January 17th at thetomeshow.com. Host Jeff Greiner will be announcing the name of the next open design project and speaking with the author. Visit KobolQuarterly.com for information about open design and about Kobold Quarterly, the magazine of kobolds and dragons.
And that's episode 40. I feel so old. As always, I urge and welcome listeners to help the show in any way you can. Some of the best ways is to participate or visit the Tome's Amazon store. Send in your emails or audio comments to thetomeshow@gmail.com or let me know if you're interested in reporting for the show regularly. You can also dig the show at dig.com, vote for us at Podcast Alley, or leave an iTunes review. All of these things help the show get noticed, and I really appreciate that. Also, don't forget to consider checking out the Tome's Amazon store. The show gets a percentage of the proceeds, and that helps keep the show on the air. All this information, the forum, and more can be found on the website at www.thetomeshow.com. Also, don't forget to check out the Tome's partner podcast, Fistful of Comics and Games, at www.fistfulofcomics.com for all sorts of geeky goodness, and Gamers Haven at www.canadiancrusaders for some great GMly advice. This has been episode 40, 4th edition rules of
The Tome.